Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Sue Prideaux about her biography of the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, entitled I Am Dynamite, A Life of Nietzsche. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us what it was that led you to write a biography of Nietzsche.
Well, I am a biographer, and I find that biographies are like, they're like a kind of fall of dominoes. One leads to the next, really. And I am half Norwegian, well, three quarters, really. And my first biography was of Edvard Munch, the Norwegian painter who painted The Scream. And the most interesting guy in his life was a Swedish playwright called August Strindberg. And Strindberg, in the 1880s, corresponded with Nietzsche. And as a direct result of that correspondence, he wrote his absolute masterpiece play, Miss Julie, very, very famous play, always being put on. And then Strindberg went to Berlin, where he hooked up with my first subject, with Edvard Munch, and the two of them became great friends, and they had a great bohemian time together. And Strindberg introduced Munch to Nietzsche's writings. And it was the following summer that Munch went back to Norway, and he painted The Scream. And I think, you know, there's no doubt that reading Nietzsche, and particularly the thought, God is dead, played a large part in the composition of this extraordinarily famous painting. You know, God is dead, we're all alone on this earth, help, scream.
Nietzsche is a figure with whom many people have a superficial similarity. And that's one of the reasons why reading your book might enlighten them to aspects of his life of which they might not be aware. For example, you open the book by talking a good deal about his relationship with music. And I thought that was really fascinating. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon that, and in particular upon his friendship with Richard Wagner.
Yes. Well, as I said, you know, I'd written these two biographies, and Nietzsche's writing was obviously very important to both men. And so I thought, okay, I'll go back and I'll read Nietzsche. I had been one of those teenagers who always had a Nietzsche in my back pocket. And I hadn't, you know, read him since. And I thought it would be really interesting to see, you know, how he stood up to me as a very grown-up woman. So I was very fascinated by his writing, but I didn't think that I would dare write his biography at all, you know, much too difficult. And then I read his letters, and I discovered such a wonderful human man there who I had no idea that, you know, that Nietzsche was so human. And there was a particular letter, because, as you say, Nietzsche was very, very fond of music. And when he was 23, 24, he was becoming a professor of philology at Basel University, and he was invited to meet Richard Wagner. and Nietzsche absolutely worshipped Wagner's music. It was, you know, what made his life worthwhile. Wagner was 52 and world famous and coming to the end of writing The Ring Cycle. And so Nietzsche thought, oh gosh, I'd better have a new suit made for this. So he went to his tailor and he ordered a suit. And the evening came and the tailor arrived with the new evening suit and Nietzsche tried it on. He writes all this in a letter, you know, tells it like a story. So here I am, you know, trying on the suit and it fits beautifully. And then, of course, the tailor wants payment. And Nietzsche didn't have the money just then, you know, young men often don't. And so he describes him and the tailor wrestling with the suit. And of course, the tailor wins. And Nietzsche says, and there I was, an insignificant little man in my shirt tails, thinking, well, my old black velvet will just have to be good enough. And he rushes off and he meets Wagner and they bond tremendously, and it's the start of, you know, such an important friendship, the most important friendship in Nietzsche's life, really. And I read that letter and I thought, good heavens, you know, Nietzsche's funny. He tells stories against himself. This is something I didn't suspect at all. And that was really when I thought, well, you know, there might be room for a biography of Nietzsche, you know, putting emphasis on the life and putting sort of human flesh on those dry philosophical bones.
Another thing that your biography does is it demonstrates just how close he was to all these current intellectual currents that were going through Europe at the time, these cultural currents, not just Wagner, but you have him meeting this very impressive array of scholars and performers in Europe during the latter half of the 19th century. And it really does push back against the image of the scholar in the ivory tower who's penning all these works that reflect a lack of engagement, when in fact, as you demonstrate, he's very much in some respects at the center of these trends that are taking place in Europe at this time.
Yes, I think particularly during the Wagner years, because of course Wagner is coming to the end of his 20-year composition of The Ring Cycle, that very important cycle of four operas. And it was really, it needed a new opera house built for The Ring because it has such a huge orchestra, etc. And so Wagner gets Nietzsche on board as almost a sort of propagandist, really, to spread the word. And then the other person who Nietzsche is given a room in Wagner's house, and he works in Wagner's house. And the other person who's given a room in Wagner's house is King Ludwig of Bavaria, who's bankrolling the whole project. And so there's this sort of intellectual circle who are trying to push forward this new artwork that they all feel is incredibly important.
It really is interesting to consider that in the context of his childhood and his upbringing. I wonder if you could take us back a bit and explain Nietzsche's background, his family and his upbringing and how that family shaped and influenced him as a young man.
Yes, he was born in 1844 in a very, very tiny hamlet, really, almost an expanded farm in Röcken in North Germany. And his father was a clergyman and his mother was the daughter of a clergyman. She hadn't received much education, but she was very pious. And Nietzsche is the firstborn to this very religious household. And then a couple of years later, his sister Elizabeth is born. And then finally, there's baby Joseph. And when Nietzsche is about 3 years old, his father starts to lose his mind, basically, lose both his sight and his mind. He goes insane and he takes about a year eventually to die. And it's quite mysterious. It could be hereditary insanity. There was insanity in the family. It could be syphilis. what was diagnosed after the post-mortem was brain softening, but that can cover a multitude of sins. And particularly, you know, if a clergyman dies of tertiary syphilis, you're going to disguise it a little bit in those days. So we don't actually know what he died of. And then Nietzsche was, as you can imagine, extremely affected by this. And he had a very strange dream. And it obviously meant a great deal to him because he writes about it. And he dreamt that his father rose up from the grave in his grave clothes and hurried across the graveyard and came into the house and fetched baby Joseph and carried him back, and the two of them disappeared into the father's grave. And this was the dream. And sometime later, Joseph did, in fact, die. And so this, well, insanity, death, early death, these were shadows. They cast very long shadows over Nietzsche's childhood and indeed the family, really. And so he lives really all his life thinking, because his father was, I think, only 36 when he died. And Nietzsche has this thing of, you know, I may not live long and I may go mad. So I've really, you know, got to sort of get there and do it now. So it was him and his mother and Elizabeth. And they, of course, had to move out of the, you know, out of the clergyman's house so that the next clergyman could take over the job. And they moved to a town called Naumburg, and Nietzsche was sent to a tremendously intellectual school called Schulpforter. And it was a sort of, it was in an old monastery, and it was a sort of monastic, semi-military, really, education. They were up at four, and every quarter of an hour was accounted for, and they weren't allowed to read any newspapers. Nothing of the present day was to, you know, sort of intrude on their education. Well, they became the most amazing classicists, and they were encouraged to speak Greek and Roman and Latin to each other. So that was quite an education, really. And Nietzsche, as you pointed out earlier, had this tremendous talent for music and tremendous love of music. And I think it was probably bound up also with his love of his father, who was also an amazing musician. And Nietzsche really first wanted to be a musician, but that really wasn't considered a serious profession in that school at all. And so he was steered towards philology, which is, you know, the science of language, and particularly the science of, he was a classical philologist, so particularly the science of ancient Greek and Latin.
And as you describe, he is a really successful early on as a philologist, to the point where he's able to earn a position at Basel without even taking a degree.
That's right. And he was 24, so he was the youngest professor that I'd ever had. And so there he was, a professor at Basel. Yeah.
So why doesn't Nietzsche stay with philology? Why does he ultimately abandon that and move on? It was philology not satisfying for him? Did he always view philology as sort of a stopgap to bigger and better things?
You know how it is. I think first of all, you know, if you're in your 20s and you get offered a flattering job and you think that's absolutely fine, you know, it's great, isn't it? And then after you've been doing it a few years, you realize that maybe this isn't the right place for you. And he describes his fellow philologists as, let's think off the top of my head, blind burrowing moles, burrowing underground after worms, and delighted when they can catch a worm in the dark, and paying no attention at all to the real problems of this world.
And that does, I think, that highlights that contrast between the young man who's going to Basel and the person that you've already referenced, who is engaging with this foremost composer who is involved in a lot of these cultural currents. That transition really is an interesting one. And I thought that part of your book was very fascinating about how he starts out in philology, he writes a couple books, and then there's this point at which he almost burns his bridges with I believe it's his second book, Birth of Tragedy, and pretty soon he's abandoning, he's losing his students, and you start to see this break emerging with him and the university.
That's right. That's right. Because of Wagner and because of thinking about Wagner, he's thinking really about the duality of man. And so he writes The Birth of Tragedy, which is famous for proposing that all culture in the past and also going forward relies on the dichotomy between the Apollonian, the rational, the logical, and the Dionysian, which is the intuitive, the wild, the orgiastic, the drunken, if you like, and that there's got to be a balance between those two in order for culture to flourish and for creativity to flourish. And this didn't really go down very well in Bismarck's Reich in the 70s, where they didn't really, you know, logic and rationality and machines were the way forward. And the thought of resurrecting the Dionysian virtues, just wasn't the flavor of the moment. So that lost him really his students. There were only two students who signed on to his course afterwards, and really lost him his reputation amongst the philologists.
And at that point, he's already starting to push toward philosophy. You describe how he explores the idea of taking a chair in philosophy instead, but that doesn't pan out.
It doesn't pan out. No. So in fact, you know, although we call Nietzsche a philosopher, he never held a philosophy chair. And up till now, really sort of, up to The Birth of Tragedy, it's really sort of cultural criticism rather than philosophy that he's been writing.
So as that part of his life starts to wind down, how does he then begin to branch out? What is it that he seeks to do as that opportunity at Basel seems to be closing to him?
Well, I think we need really, in a way, to go back to his school days to answer that question properly. Because Nietzsche was, 14 when Darwin published his Origin of Species, you know, evolution. That really is the foundation, if you like, for all of Nietzsche's thinking. Because, you know, Darwin really sort of raised the big, big questions, you know. That's really sort of where Nietzsche starts to think about the death of God. And of course, he's the only one who really looks at what Darwin is saying, and he thinks, you know, the theory of evolution really challenges the whole universal mythology of form and design that shaped European sort of belief and purpose and morality and culture for over 1,000 years. And no wonder everyone was really denying the implications of Darwin, you know, because everything people had believed in, everything that gave life meaning, had really been removed. You know, if you were going to kill God, where do you find meaning? If there's no heaven to aim at, what are you aiming at? If religious rules no longer apply, you know, where do you find morality? And so this is really, right from the start, right from when he's at school, Nietzsche's asking these questions and sort of writing about these questions. And I think that's what he felt was, you know, his task in life, really, to answer those questions, or to try to find answers to those questions.
So how does he go about that process of searching for those answers?
Well, it takes him a long time. When he's he doesn't yet resign from Basel. He takes when he is still professor at Basel, and this is quite interesting. There is a vote for whether women should be allowed to attend lectures to become students. And Nietzsche votes yes. He's one of only four who vote yes. And this is quite ironical, really, given his reputation for misogyny that's so widespread. But anyway, he votes yes. And when he goes to the first Bayreuth festival, when Wagner's actually got his operas up and running, Nietzsche meets a prominent feminist called Malvida von Meisenbug. And she kind of takes him under her wing. And they go to Sorrento to found what they call a school for free spirits, which is wonderful. And the free spirits are people who are prepared to look the death of God in the eye and see what on earth, the consequences are. And so he writes a book called Beyond Good and Evil. And it's really looking into all the things that you believe and all the things that you've been taught to believe just to see whether they stand up to your examination or whether they're just sort of superstitions that have been handed down. And so when you've done this, you have then an idea of yourself, and then he says you become who you are. You have then become who you are because you know what you are. You know that you're not just a bundle of borrowed opinions. Yeah. Then you have to look at your life, and then you have to love your life. You have to examine it very carefully. And you have to love your life, particularly, if you like, all the things you've done wrong, all the mistakes you've made, all the pain and the suffering. All of those you must examine, and all of those you must learn to love. He calls it amor fati, love your life. And then, if a demon came and said, you've got to live your life all over again, to the end of time, you would then greet the demon with great joy, saying, my life on earth is the only thing I have here. There's nothing outside. And I would rejoice in living it again and again and again. Then you're an ubermensch, because then you've purged yourself of guilt, of decadence, and of resentment. And then you can go forward into the world strong and, authentically. You're no longer inauthentic. You're no longer borrowing other people's beliefs. So that's what this School of Free Spirits was doing. And Malvida, the feminist who sort of set up the school, incidentally, it never came to anything. It was just a theory. But there were people who came in and out. And there were quite a lot of early feminist women who came, because, women were not barred from this experiment. And there were a couple who Nietzsche encouraged mightily, gave them reading lists and so on and so forth. And this particular couple of women I'm thinking of, both of them achieved their doctorates at a Swiss university. They were among the first. Well, I think one of them was the first woman to achieve a doctorate at a Swiss university. So it's a pretty sort of revolutionary time, really. You're not only saying there's probably no God, but you're also saying, women who didn't have proper education then and certainly didn't have the vote, they can come along with us. If they're clever enough and keep up, on we go.
Nietzsche's relationship with women is something that really stands out in the book. I was particularly struck by your sections talking about his sister Elizabeth and what a formidable personality it was. And I especially thought your description of her enterprise in Paraguay was of a special interest, because it really seemed to be the point at which she really stands out as you know, independent from her mother and everything, and you really get a sense as to who she was, and this question then comes up of, well, you know, how much does that end up influencing how Nietzsche thinks of women, this incredibly forceful personality who engages in this rather remarkable adventure.
That's right. Well, she obviously was a very strong personality because, I mean, when they were children, they had a natural history book at home, and there was an entry on the llama, you know, the animal, the llama. And it said the llama is a very obstinate animal. When it's cross, it spits, foul-smelling spit. And when it really doesn't want to do something, it's so obstinate, it just lays down on the ground and says, I want to die. And so Nietzsche then picked this up, and forever after, he called his sister the llama. And you get these letters saying, dear llama, dear faithful llama, you know, and and Elizabeth quite likes it, except for the foul smelling spit bit. She never quotes that one, but otherwise she's quite pleased to be called a llama. And Nietzsche, again, he tries to educate her. When he's at school and he gets his religious doubts, he says to Elizabeth, you know, if you want to be happy, believe, but life is really much more interesting if you introduce doubt and try to become who you are and what you are, rather than just a sort of Christian cipher, you know, someone who says they believe in Christianity because it's the easiest thing to do. So that's him and Elizabeth, and he wants her to go to university lectures, but she doesn't like that. She likes the old-fashioned idea of being a woman, being a subsidiary, you know, to a man, and being flirtatious and charming and getting her way that way. And then in the 80s, I don't think she falls in love, actually, but she feels it's sort of her last chance to get married. And there is this horrible anti-Semitic nationalist agitator called Bernard Förster. And he's a sort of Nazi before there were Nazis, really. You know, he gets into fights in the street because, you know, he thinks people are Jews, and he's a real horror. And incidentally, actually, before we get onto this, one of the reasons that Nietzsche broke with Wagner was Wagner's anti-Semitism and his nationalism. So Nietzsche's against both of those. So anyway, so Elizabeth eventually marries Bernard Förster, and Nietzsche refuses to meet him because he says, you know, his views are just impossible. But Nietzsche feels that he must shake him hands once and wish him luck, and that's it. And so off they go to Paraguay to found an anti-Semitic colony where only Aryans of pure blood will go. And they get these kind of carpenters and farmers and about 60 families, and they all go out to Paraguay. And the whole thing's a sort of terrible swindle, because Elizabeth and Förster don't own the land at all, and these poor people have paid them to go out, and there's no sewage, there's no roads, there's no infrastructure, nothing. And it becomes a great scandal, and Förster kills himself. But Elizabeth is still sort of sending home wonderful propaganda things, saying, oh, it's all going so beautifully, all going so beautifully. So that's Elizabeth. And, I mean, every good book, even a book about a philosopher, needs a villain. And, oh, boy, we've got one in her.
You're describing there how Nietzsche was against nationalism and anti-Semitism, and that gets to sort of how he is misrepresented, especially with his association with Nazism in the 1930s, which cherry picked what they wanted from it to represent to give themselves a sort of intellectual patina. But I thought it was interesting also how he is. It still has that fascinating association. I mean, the idea that he is with Wagner all that time, and that only really comes out later near the tail end. What led Nietzsche to that point? Did he suddenly realize that Wagner was anti-Semitic and nationalist, or was it just becoming more evident as Wagner's fame grew and as Bayreuth became much more of an event and attracted all the attention from the Kaiser and other various notaries?
Yes, I think that's certainly it, because he was very idealistic about Bayreuth and about Wagner, and it became a sort of society circus, really. The ring cycle every year, everyone dressing up in fancy clothes to go there, rather than a festival for the masses to reinvigorate Germany's culture. What were we? You were talking about? The breach with Wagner. The Franco-Prussian War broke out, and Nietzsche felt right from the start he hated the Reich, and he hated what Bismarck was doing to Germany, uniting Germany in a huge, great militaristic power. And Nietzsche said, He said several times, "I don't mind. I may be a bad German, but I'm a good European." And he felt that Europe was a tremendously important cultural unit. And he saw nothing at all fruitful in nationalism. He saw it as divisive. And then, of course, the Franco-Prussian War breaks out, and Nietzsche doesn't want to fight because he sees himself as a good European, but he does feel that he should serve his country, and so he volunteers as an ambulance attendant, and he sees the terrible, terrible battlefields. He goes in trains from battlefield to battlefield with the wounded, taking them to hospital, picking them up again, and so on, including the Battle of Worth, where tens of thousands died. The number isn't exact. And there, from the people who he's nursing, he contracts dysentery and diphtheria and possibly syphilis. We're not quite sure about that. And so he has to, he has to take compassionate leave. And then he comes back and sees Wagner. And Wagner is in full flight of nationalism and rubbing his hands at the French suffering. And Wagner's even refusing to read letters that are written to him in French, So Wagner's being totally absurd. And this, I think, caused a very sharp division. Nietzsche's, the scales sort of fell from Nietzsche's eyes. And his dislike of Wagner's anti-Semitism, he could now express. Nietzsche is not innocent of anti-Semitism himself, and anti-Semitic remarks when he is with Wagner. But also, when you're unpicking the whole Nietzsche and anti-Semitism thing, what you want to look at is it's not his hatred of the Jewish people very often, it's his hatred of the Jewish religion and indeed Judeo-Christianity. So it's not just confined to the Jewish religion, it's Judeo-Christianity. So it's quite a, it's quite a sort of intricate and complicated question, all that.
We've been talking about Nietzsche's books and his arguments. One of the things you do in your book, though, is you describe the challenge he faced in terms of getting his ideas out there. I thought that the mundane subject of him getting published was one of those fascinating parts, because you have this example of a person who is writing these books, that some of which are going to be profoundly important to Western thought, and he is struggling simply to get them out there because, apart from perhaps a few of his friends, nobody's reading them, and his friends are reading them because he's sending them gratis copies.
That's right. That's right. So you know, anyone listening who's thinking of self-publishing, go ahead. No, poor man. No, he'd written about five, and they weren't, of course, selling. And on average, I think The Birth of Tragedy sold 300 copies. When you think what a famous book it is now. And then his publisher simply refused when he started writing, when he wanted to publish Thus Spake Zarathustra. And from then on, Nietzsche had to pay for publication of his own books. And they sold in tiny, tiny numbers. But he kept on writing. It's rather marvelous, really.
His pace of writing over the course of the 1880s, it was just, you describe how he finishes one book and he almost immediately starts another one. Mm. He's producing them at such a rapid pace.
Mm. It's brain fever. But then his usually they're pretty short. We haven't really gone into Nietzsche's health. Again, we have to go back to his childhood and when he was at school. And he had terrible problems with his stomach and terrible problems with his eyes. And so he would spend weeks in bed in a darkened room because the light hurt his eyes so much. It was like, do you say migraines or migraines in America? Anyway, it was one
migraines.
Of those. Migraines, okay. Migraines lasting a long, long time. Plus, stomach and vomiting, sometimes even vomiting blood. And of course, it's quite extraordinary, you know, when you think it's not so long ago, but how they coped with this was so medieval. They would put leeches on his ears and on his head to suck away the blood, which he hated, as you can imagine. And he felt it did him no good, and he hated these revolting leeches. So he has these terrible, you know, eye problems. Difficult to see. So he's not like a writer like you and me who can sit down all day at the computer and produce words, words, words. He really has to ration his time. So what he does, he finds that it's very inspirational to walk. So he walks and he has a little notebook in his pocket and a little pencil, and he's wearing his green eyeshade and probably a peaked cap over that. And when a thought comes to him, he'll try and note it down. Of course, at the end of the day, he probably can't read quite a lot of his writing, and that makes him quite cross. But anyway, this is the origin, really, of his aphoristic style, his writing in bursts and writing in very concentrated bursts, so that, you know, many of his books are written within a space of 2 or 3 weeks. So he's thinking, then he's, you know, getting it all down, and then he's putting it together. Terrible, laborious process.
But it really is the only one that he can do, given his medical ailments and his in his other in his broader situation.
Yeah, that's right. So he suffered, poor man.
So could you describe the events that lead to his institutionalization? Because you capture a lot of the drama of the sense of a person who is increasingly in his own world, and how people have to suddenly now come to terms with that.
Yes. There's sort of endless to-ing and fro-ing about a couple of things, really, about whether he had syphilis or not, whether it was syphilis or in hereditary insanity, and also the onset of this, when it started, because as you said, he wrote a heck of a lot of books in his last year. He sort of wrote three just like that. And they are entirely magical and inspired. But there are people who would say that they are actually, the result of an overheated mind. But, that doesn't matter. Because there are plenty of marvelous poets like, say, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote on laudanum and opium and sort of inspired by more than just mere thought. So he writes these books, and then he goes to Turin, which he finds a very, very sympathetic city. He loves Turin. And then he, in a square in Turin, he breaks down. And it's a square where there are a lot of cab horses, ready to pull passengers in cabs around the town and so on and so forth. And they're thin and their ribs stick out and they're pathetic creatures, really. And Nietzsche is just overcome with pity. And he puts his arms around a cab horse and he just weeps. And that's it. And his mind is gone. And then luckily his landlord comes and rescues him. And then he is alive for the following 11 years, unfortunately, in the loving care of his sister Elizabeth. And that's the end of his sane life, really.
And yet it's just at that point that you start to see people picking up his ideas and starting to actually do something with him. It's part of that final tragedy that he's fading from the scene as more and more people are starting to engage with what he's trying to say.
That's the absolutely amazing thing. And you remember at the start I talked about my biography of Strindberg, the Swedish playwright Strindberg. And it was just the year before, really, that Nietzsche lost his mind, that he and Strindberg started corresponding, because there was a Danish literary critic called Georg Brandes, who was tremendously famous literary critic. He did sort of tours of the United States where he got garlanded with, bay leaves and things. And he promoted Nietzsche's writings. And so they were read in Scandinavia, in America, etc., etc. And the year he went mad, his writing took off.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Who do you do after Nietzsche? All suggestions welcome. Actually, the thing is, I haven't yet put Nietzsche to bed. You've got to get your subject out of your head before you can let anyone else in. So I hope somebody else will come knocking at the door soon. We'll see.
Well, I hope that is very soon indeed. Sue Prideaux, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Mark.